Welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Laura Pfeiffer, and I'm a naturopathic doctor helping you take your hormones from chaos to calm. In this podcast, I'm searching the internet, mainly Reddit, to find out what you are talking about. I'm diving into the questions you have, the things you are too embarrassed to talk about, and helping you navigate our healthcare system with ease. This is the Hormone Hub Podcast.
Hello, hello. Welcome to episode 3 of my new format. I'm so happy that you're here. This is going to be posted a little bit late because I've had this chronic sinus thing I have going on. And, you know, maybe I'll save that conversation for another date, but my voice, as you can hear, doesn't sound great. I can assure you my voice sounds better in my episode that I actually recorded last week. So today we're going to be talking about a Reddit thread that talks about feeling dry and broken. This is something that my patients are, you know, asking me about or talking with me about a lot. And so in this episode, I'm going to cover a few things. We're going to talk about vaginal dryness in menopause and perimenopause. So if this is something that makes you feel uncomfortable, throw in some headphones, maybe don't listen to it in the car with your kids. But really, I just want to open up the conversation. In this episode, I'm covering why you have heavy periods in that transition through perimenopause to menopause, but don't turn the episode off if you are not in perimenopause. I'm talking about why you have vaginal dryness even when you're not in perimenopause, as well as the reasons for vaginal dryness in that transition. I'm also talking about naturopathic treatment options and things that you should consider in your treatment plan. So if you are feeling dry and broken, you are not alone. You are in the right space. I'm so excited to get into it.
Hello, I am super happy to be back here 3 weeks in a row. I am, as you can see, hoping to continue to do this weekly because I really love this medium for learning and listening myself, as well as doing it because it allows me to have a long form communication and it allows you a variety of different ways to engage with it. So, as you can see, I do this via video. If you want to watch it on YouTube, that's an option. I usually post clips on my social media, and so if you're interested in the clips I post, the long-form information will be found on this podcast. And obviously, you can listen anywhere you find your podcasts, so it's pretty cool to be able to, I know I throw in my headphones and listen to whatever I'm listening to that day, so I'm hoping that it benefits you in that way. If you have any feedback for me, I'm always happy to get that. So let's get into it. We are episode 3 of this new format, and I'm super excited. So I hope you guys get as much benefit out of it as I do putting it out there because I really enjoy sharing this information and hope that it's helpful. As always, you can follow me on my social media platforms. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Instagram. Same username. So it's at Dr. Laura ND. And shoot me a DM. Shoot me a message. Give me some feedback. Subscribe to the podcast because I'm hoping to have it out weekly going forward. So let's get into it. Today, we are talking about feeling dry and broken, which is something a lot of my patients can relate to, especially as it pertains to perimenopause. But it doesn't always pertain to perimenopause. So I want to talk about vaginal dryness in a real sense. I want to talk about perimenopause. And I want to talk about some things you can do with it. Sorry, I'm just moving my hair out of the way because I don't want it to interfere with the microphone. So if you're watching on video, this is why I'm playing with my hair because I'm just trying to move it so the microphone doesn't sound all, white noisy. Okay, so here we are. Let's get into it. I'm going to read this Reddit post. It's called "I Feel Broken," and in brackets it says "perimenopause?" question mark. "Hello, ladies. I'm sorry if the title seems a bit melodramatic. I've been miserable. I do have an appointment with my OB, but I guess I just need a vent or need some reassurance or something. I'm feeling a little bit unstable. I had a baby at 39. Birth was a C-section and had my OB tie my tubes while in there. Lost an ovary during that process. Relevant? I don't know. Baby turned 2 this weekend, and since she was born, my periods have been a mess. They're regular like clockwork, but they're so heavy. Like, it's hard to leave the house for the first 3 days because I'm soaking through Ultra tampons in an hour, and I have to wear Depends because I can't have a pad shifting on me or I'd ruin everything in the house. My OB wanted to start me on hormonal birth control to see if it would help get things under control. I've never been on hormonal birth control in my life, and I was a little bit nervous. I was anticipating feeling or acting a bit crazy. I wasn't anticipating my body going to pieces on me. I feel like the biggest wimp on the planet. I could only hang in for a couple of weeks. I know it takes time to adjust, but I was just so, so sick. Headaches, flaring to migraines, nausea, dizziness, exhaustion, body aches, everything. I'd be trying to fix lunch for the family and be stirring stuff on the stove and have to spin around to vomit in the kitchen sink. Suddenly, my nether regions turned into the damn Sahara, to the point that internal chafing was turning into tearing. I couldn't keep on like that for 3 months and honestly just don't have the fortitude to try to get it dialed in. I mean, I'll do what I have to, but I'm really hoping for maybe an ablation or something because damn, that was horrible. Had to take a break from intimacy with the husband because of the chafing. Got some over-the-counter products to try and help healing. Got the green light from the OB to stop pills. Period started only a day late, and it was horrible as usual. Finally, feeling better, and husband and I went to play Friday night. Oh my God, the pain. I can't even tell you. I felt like I was going to be ripped in half. And yes, I was plenty ready. Last night, I wanted to try again as I hoped it was just a fluke, but no. I wish I could describe the pain. It's unreal. I know I've got to wait to talk to my OB, but I'm just so lost. I'm scared. I'm lonely. I feel broken. Unfortunately, this is something that I hear all the time from my patients, and it is something a lot of my patients, women in particular, suffer from in silence because we just don't talk about it. A lot of the times, even when I'm talking to a patient who's, you know, in menopause, fully in menopause, we know they're menopausal, they don't actually come to me with low sex drive or vaginal dryness as their main concern because it feels uncomfortable. And as I work virtually with my patients, 99% of the time, I'm usually sitting across from someone on a computer and I don't necessarily know where they are in their house. I don't know who's home. And a lot of women are completely comfortable talking about their hot flashes in front of their kids, in front of their husband, but nobody wants to talk about their vaginal dryness or pain with sex or low libido. And if they do, it's very few and far between. And so a lot of times I'll say, where are you? Who's home? Can we talk about sex drive? And I usually get the like looking around, okay, 1 second. And they go into a different room because this is something they weren't prepared to talk about, even though it's a significant problem. And so I wanted to take the opportunity in this episode to just shed some light on this issue, give a little bit of insight, and hopefully give you a little bit of reassurance or hope as it pertains to this issue. And I understand feeling broken. Intimacy is something that is needed for the lifetime. There's no time in your life where it's like, oh yeah, no, you don't need it anymore. You're fine. You should be able to express that intimacy with a partner or with whoever you want, quite frankly. So this is really interesting. There's a lot of different layers. And so the first thing I want to address is she actually in perimenopause or menopause? And what does that mean? What does that look like? And then the second thing I want to really dive into is reasons for vaginal dryness in menopause, in perimenopause, even in younger women. And then the last thing I want to touch on is what to do with it. So that's what you can expect from this episode. So let's really get into it. Perimenopause, what is it? What happens? And how do you know if you're in perimenopause versus menopause? And then we need to touch on these heavy periods. And so just going back to this original post, they're talking about the fact that they had a hysterectomy, I believe it was a hysterectomy. My point is that they lost an ovary and they're wondering if that's relevant. And so yes, you make your hormones from your ovaries. And now as you transition from, you know, regularly cycling to perimenopause and menopause, your ovaries are going to do a lot less work. So you're going to make a lot less hormones. And what happens is as you're transitioning, the role of the ovaries gets less and less and less, and the role becomes on your adrenals. It becomes the responsibility of your adrenal glands to make some of those sex hormones. Now, our sex hormones don't completely go away, you know, down to zero, but they do significantly decline. And so understanding that is really important. And so how do we know if we're actually in menopause? Oh, my, just 1 second. You know, I have a spam phone call coming in as I'm trying to record a podcast, which is great and lovely. Hopefully the recording can't hear it. Anyways, moving forward. in perimenopause, we have that transition. So we have that the role that was initially from our ovaries making our sex hormones goes on to our adrenals. And now what happens is if you, for some reason, have an ovary removed, you may or may not go into premature menopause. And the reason for that is really kind of random a little bit, because if we think about it, throughout our lifetime, we're going to ovulate from one ovary or another. Sometimes I always refer to it in a joking manner as you have one ovary that's like gung-ho and ready to rock and maybe works a little bit harder. And then you have one ovary that might be lazy, right? It might not ovulate every month. Maybe you ovulate every other month from one ovary and every other month from another one. It's really hard to say what's going to happen, but you have one egg that comes from one or another. And some people tend to ovulate from maybe their left more often than their right. So let's just say throughout whatever procedure, you end up having to lose your left ovary. Well, that's not good news because wait, your right was a little bit lazy. So maybe as soon as you get out of that surgery, you're now not ovulating as frequently because your right ovary only wanted to take over every 3 months. This is just me giving a scenario, right? This isn't necessarily how it always works, but we don't necessarily know why, which one ovary may ovulate, you know, every single time or every third time, every second time. And so if you just happen to get that one removed, you may notice those differences right away. And on the flip side, if you're somebody who, let's say that left ovary stayed and that was the one that ovulated the majority of the time, you might not actually notice anything right away, right? So that's the first piece. And so those ovaries are responsible for making sex hormones. And if we take that one away, the one that was, you know, the hard worker, then we're going to experience those symptoms earlier. And so what can those symptoms look like? We talk about heavy periods. We talk about heavy bleeding. Let's go back to the root causes. Now, if you're someone who was diagnosed with, let's say, endometriosis, then we know why you have heavy periods, why you bleed a lot. But if there was no structural cause, like endometriosis or fibroids, a lot of the times individuals have heavy periods or bleed a lot can be due to an ovulatory cycle, so not ovulating. Why does this happen? Because at the beginning of your period, think about it as the building. We're building up the lining. We're building up the follicles. We're getting ready for ovulation. The middle of your cycle is ovulation. We let out that egg. We're preparing for fertilization. And then what happens is that egg is waiting to be fertilized and it creates a corpus luteum. The corpus luteum makes progesterone. That progesterone is a progest hormone waiting for this fertilization. When that doesn't happen, progesterone goes down, estrogen goes down, we have a bleed, it starts all over. So what happens when we don't ovulate? When we don't ovulate, we're not making that progesterone to oppose that estrogen. And so a lot of times we can either A, make a lining that is pretty thick, and B, we can have some breakthrough bleeding as a result because there's unopposed estrogen. And so really it depends on the person, but when you don't ovulate, you're more likely to have heavy periods, painful periods, PMS, worse acne, breast tenderness, that sort of thing. That's all a part of that estrogen dominant picture. And so in perimenopause, we have this happening randomly. And what happens if we took away her ovary that was, like I said, working harder, she might have more cycles where she's bleeding heavily as a result of not ovulating. Now, there's lots of other reasons for having heavy periods, but this is one of the things I see in perimenopause. The other thing that's interesting is a lot of women tend to be iron deficient, and I've spoke about this in the last podcast episode. So take a look, check it out. But a lot of women tend to be iron deficient, and the fact of being iron deficient can actually cause your periods to be heavy. So I know a lot of people say, well, I take iron because I'm iron deficient because I have heavy periods. But the catch 22 on that is that an iron deficiency can actually cause heavy periods. Other things that can cause heavy periods are like a thyroid abnormality. So if you haven't had your thyroid checked out and you're bleeding and bleeding and bleeding, that's something that needs to be addressed. And then we talk about PCOS. PCOS, again, you're more likely to have anovulatory cycles. You're also more likely to have blood sugar imbalances, and blood sugar imbalances can impact your cycle as well. But if you don't have an ovulation, then you're more likely to have that heavy period. And so this is what we see a lot of the time. And so this person, oh, and you know what? I'm going back to, I said there was a hysterectomy, but then I remember her saying that she wanted an ablation. So there was no hysterectomy. It was a C-section with tubes tied and she lost an ovary. So I will just correct myself there. So still has a uterus, obviously, because I'm talking about bleeding. Where is my brain today? But anyways, this person has a uterus, lost an ovary, and this is my point. We're talking about hormones and we're talking about bleeding. So anyways, going back to that, how do we know kind of what's going on from a hormone standpoint or what to do to for the bleeding, how to understand? So if your periods are coming every single month, then it's a really easy thing to do. We can track your ovulation using an ovulation test strip. And then 7 to 10 days after that positive strip, we do a progesterone test. So we do that in blood. There is a company called Prove that will do it in urine. So you can do it at home and it's super easy. And you would test if your progesterone is positive. If your progesterone is high enough, that will confirm that you actually ovulated. And so that gives us a really good gauge of whether or not you ovulated that month. Because just kind of going back to that, remember luteinizing hormone, LH strips, ovulation test strips are just a predictor, and then progesterone will confirm that. So making sure that we're actually, testing at the right time, 7 days after a positive LH. Then we would test progesterone to confirm whether or not you're ovulating. And typically in these patients, I will do on that date, usually it's day 21 or 7 days after ovulation. And I will also I'll run an estrogen, a progesterone, a testosterone. Usually I'll do, a thyroid panel, add in some fasting insulin just to get a greater idea of other things that could be going on. And if you're making enough estrogen and progesterone to see. So that is one way to check. Another thing to measure can be your FSH or your follicle stimulating hormone. Why do we do that? Because when your follicle stimulating hormone gets too high, that indicates you're in menopause. So if you're like, well, I think I'm in menopause, but I'm not sure, an FSH can tell us that because if it's over 27, I'm here in Ontario, but if it's over 27, then that will indicate that you are in menopause. And then we can take those steps because now we understand that you aren't expected to ovulate anymore, right? And just to differentiate between perimenopause and menopause, you can be in perimenopause for a really long time. You can be in perimenopause for years. And so understanding when that change happens. So what'll happen is menopause is when you haven't had a period for 1 year. And so perimenopause can be grueling because you might have a period and then, 4 months later you have another period and then 6 months later you have another period. And so this can be a grueling process because you're like, I have hot flashes, I have random periods, they're heavy here and they're, heavy over here and light here and then don't come for 4 months. And so you're kind of wondering when you're going to get a period, B, if you're going to get a period, and C, is this going to be the last one? So doing a lot of these measurements can be helpful and understanding that there's actually a lot we can do to alleviate your symptoms in this perimenopausal period. So that's a really important thing to understand as well. All right, let's get into reasons for vaginal dryness in menopause and perimenopause, as well as in younger individuals. The first thing to understand is that shifting levels of hormones, so specifically estrogen, during that menopause transition, actually produces changes in a woman's body. Both the vagina and the external female genitalia are affected. So the vulva, I've talked about this before in the other episode, 10 things you need to know about your vagina or your hoo-ha, as the name would describe. I like to say vagina, but I was just trying to, be a little bit cheeky for the title. But both the vagina and the vulva, which is the external female genitals, are affected. And so estrogen plays a huge role. During perimenopause and menopause, we can get something called vulvovaginal atrophy. So during this time shift, less estrogen can actually cause the tissues of the vulva and the lining of the vagina to become thinner, drier, less elastic or flexible. And in this, vaginal secretions are also reduced. This results in reduced lubrication. Reduced level of estrogen also results in an increase in vaginal pH. And if you go back to my vagina episode, you'll understand why this is such a problem. Vaginal pH is really critical to protecting the vagina and to protecting the barrier. And so when the vagina becomes less acidic, you're more likely to get infections and things like that. But also, we have this estrogen deficiency that causes an increased pH, which can predispose to mechanical weakness as well as infections. And then we go into, I talked a little bit about, or I spoke a little bit about the microbiome of the vagina in our vagina episode. And so if you want to learn more about that, head there. But this is one of the reasons why we get vaginal dryness and pain, because the estrogen, the low estrogen, causes this atrophy, this thinning and lack of lubrication. That's the main reason. But let's talk about how it can be impacted in younger women as well, because we know the main cause in menopause. Let's talk about the main causes in younger women. So the first thing is external things that we put in our vagina. So douching and other irritants. Again, I talked about this in the last episode, talking about soaps, lotions, perfumes, and douches. They all disrupt our natural pH. They disrupt our microbiome, and this can lead to dryness. Cigarette smoking. It's one of the things that all women should never do, because cigarette smoking can cause a decline in estrogen levels regardless of age and can actually predispose to vaginal dryness. When we talk about postpartum, because this person is talking, now they have a 2-year-old, but again, they've also had an ovary removed. So there's a lot of factors here, but postpartum hormonal changes and lactation. In postpartum, we have a decline in estrogen. This accompanies the loss of the placental estrogen. And when you are breastfeeding and you have prolactin is antagonistic to estrogen, meaning it works against it during lactation. Again, we come down to this lowering levels of estrogen. Another cause is called vaginitis. This can lead to worsening of symptoms. So what I mean is, this is not often the main cause, but having inflammation in the vagina is obviously going to worsen and irritate if you already have dryness. So think about it. If you are already having a declining estrogen level, you pair that with a change in the pH because of a decline in estrogen. And then on top of that, you're like, okay, well, now I have a yeast infection. And then that worsens dryness and worsens pain and everything else. So certain vaginal tract infections, so yeast infections, bacterial vaginosis, trichomoniasis, sexually transmitted infections, will often exacerbate a problem which is predisposed by that lowered estrogen and altered pH. So your pH in your vagina should be between 3.5 and 4.5. And like I said before, this is essential for your immunity's natural defense against vaginal and urinary tract infections. This is one of the reasons why in perimenopause and menopause, women are getting more UTIs and more yeast infections. And then underlying hormonal conditions. So one of the ones is thyroid that I like to address. I already addressed it when we were talking about, heavy periods, because people don't realize the role that the thyroid plays. And so an underactive thyroid can cause other hormone issues. I always tell my patients, your hormones are so intricately connected that we can't really pull apart and say, it's this one hormone that's causing the problem. We have to look at the whole picture and say, okay, if this hormone is high, where's your system pulling? Where's your system more likely to move, right? And so an underactive thyroid can cause too much prolactin, so hyperprolactinemia, which is an elevated prolactin. In this case, we have reduced sex drive, breast pain, painful intercourse, and vaginal dryness. We're going to talk about blood sugar, but in diabetes, this can cause vaginal dryness itself. And Sjogren's syndrome is an autoimmune disorder that attacks cells in the body that produce moisture. Obviously, this is going to amount to losing a lot of moisture, including causing vaginal dryness. Certain medications can cause vaginal dryness. So if you are on ones especially that impact libido, libido and sexual function. So things like SSRIs, so antidepressants, we have beta blockers, so heart medications, we have anti-estrogenic medications. And again, some of the times we don't have a choice as to whether we're on some of these medications. So understanding that this is what they may be causing, this is a side effect of the medications, can be a really good first step to understanding how we treat this, right? Because I think the problem is a lot of women go without telling anybody because they might be embarrassed, or they might think that there's something wrong with them, or they might think that, oh, maybe I don't like my partner anymore, which, I mean, may be the case, but it's not going to be, in lieu of being a problem from your SSRIs or your beta blockers. Again, certain fertility medications like Provera or Lupron, or medications, other medications used to treat fibroids or endometriosis can impact your hormones in a way that causes vaginal dryness. So it's really important that we take the opportunity to say, I suffer from vaginal dryness and I'm not in menopause. And I thought, you know, something was wrong with me. But now I know that I was taking XYZ medication. And now I know that I should talk to my doctor, talk to my naturopathic doctor about how to mitigate the root cause, how to treat this side effect that I'm experiencing. And on that medication piece, a lot of people don't actually look at the birth control pill as a medication. And so the birth control pill can be associated with vaginal dryness. Studies have actually shown that between 3-5% of women on low dose birth control pills experience vaginal dryness. This is interesting because I always talk about, oh, well, how do they choose birth control pills? How do they choose hormonal contraception for you? Your doctor will take the lowest effective dose. So the idea is to use a low dose because obviously the lower, the better. We don't want you on a whole ton of hormones when you don't have to be. We want the lowest effective dose, and that's seen as the safest. But the lower the dose, again, you have to understand the mechanism of action of birth control is turning off your ovulation. And so you aren't making your own hormones. Your body is now depending on this synthetic source of hormones to run the show. And so if you're just on a low dose, this can actually increase the risk of having vaginal dryness. In one study, the proportion of women who reported vaginal dryness after 3 menstrual cycles as a result of the pill varied between 12.7% and 30.4% of the participants. This variance depended on dosage. The pills with the lowest synthetic estrogen had the highest reports of vaginal dryness. So it's interesting because you're in this like catch 22. The lowest dose of estrogen is likely the safest in all other aspects, but the lowest impact of, or the lowest dose of estrogen can increase the risk of side effects like vaginal dryness. And so what is the lesser of two evils? Obviously, if you're trying to avoid things like clots, you're like, well, I guess I'll take the vaginal dryness, but why is that the bar? Why is that where we're setting the bar that we have to, you know, women always have to go with, well, what's the worst thing we can do? Like, what's the best thing we can do of the worst, the lesser of two evils? Imagine, I can only imagine if men created this, and they were like, well, the side effect is, you know, low sex drive, but this is the one that reduces the risk of XYZ. They wouldn't choose it. They would say, no, back to the drawing board. We need a new medication. But suddenly, this is just something women deal with, right? And if we talk about the birth control pill, I could talk an hour about the birth control pill. That's not what this is about today. But we look at the fact that we deal with so many side effects, and often the same side effects that we used the pill for, right? Like, we take the pill, it's like, well, I had PMS and painful periods and breast tenderness and bloating, and they go on the pill and they're like, yeah, now I have vaginal dryness and depression and breast tenderness and bloating. And it's like, well, what are we doing? So it is important to talk about this as a cause of vaginal dryness. And if you have vaginal dryness, you're likely going to have more pain with intercourse. And if you have more pain with intercourse, you are likely to not have any sex drive. And that makes a lot of sense. Another thing to look at is blood sugar. So I mentioned the diabetes, and women who are diabetic are more likely to have vaginal dryness. And women with diabetes have a 33% increase incidence of vaginal dryness, and up to 42% of women with diabetes experience sexual dysfunction. The odds of a diabetic having painful intercourse are 3.48 times greater in postmenopausal women with diabetes. I want to just, you know, branch this out because diabetes, we know blood sugar being a problem, blood sugar can impact your ability to, create lubrication. It can also impact, especially in diabetes, we talk about blood flow. We need blood flow to nourish tissues. And if that blood flow is reduced, then we are not going to have nourished tissues. But we can also experience sexual dysfunction as well, right? We have to think of, in diabetics, we have less efficient blood flow and circulation of things. And so I look at this and I'm like, wait, but what about PCOS? The reason why I always bring up PCOS, it's like, Laura, why are you always talking about PCOS? Because we don't talk about these metabolic issues, this fasting insulin. If you have PCOS and you have a high fasting insulin and you have blood sugar issues and you're creeping towards diabetes, you may have sexual dysfunction early on and not know that it's because of the PCOS. I mean, PCOS inherently is going to cause a lot of different things that will impact your sex drive in a negative way. But one of those things is blood sugar. And so instead of just looking at your fasting glucose and your HbA1c and saying, oh, no, you're good to go, you are fine, let's look at fasting insulin. Let's bring down that fasting insulin and look at insulin resistance as a root cause of sexual dysfunction and vaginal dryness. So what do we do about it? There are a lot of treatment options from a naturopathic perspective, and I'm going to talk about a few of them that I use in my practice. But the first thing is obviously avoiding any vaginal irritants that are going to make dryness worse. So I'm talking douches, bubble baths, scented soaps, and lotions around the area. Again, I talked about this in my 10 Things You Need to Know About Your Vagina episode. These products can worsen dryness. Now, the second one is a very interesting one. Sexual activity is a treatment. The saying goes, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. Sexual activity is a prescription for atrophic vaginitis or estrogen deficiency. It basically helps encourage this vaginal elasticity and pliability, and there's the lubricative response to sexual stimulation. Women who participate in sexual activity report fewer symptoms of atrophic vaginitis and on vaginal examination have less evidence of stenosis and shrinkage in comparison with sexually inactive women. A negative relationship exists between coital activity and symptoms of vaginal atrophy. So the people who have intercourse more have less symptoms of this vaginal atrophy. If you don't use it, you lose it. But it becomes a little bit of a cycle, right? Your sex drive gets low, you don't have sex, then sex is painful, and then when you do it, it makes everything worse. So using things like lubricants can be really helpful so that you can get back into it, so then it's not painful, and so then it doesn't reduce lubrication, so you don't have atrophy, and it's this cycle, right? So yes, it is a prescription. Sometimes you're so far gone that you need treatments in order to bring you back to a point where you feel comfortable doing it, because it can be extremely traumatic if you have a history of everything being painful. There's a psychological component, feeling like, you know, you let your partner down, feeling like you don't want to start things for fear of not being able to finish things because you feel guilty. There's a lot of emotions that go along with it. And so if you feel like that's part of your picture, it might be worthwhile to work with a therapist through those feelings and through that communication with your partner to make sure that the lines of communication are open and things are comfortable for you to do so. Okay, next one is sea buckthorn oil orally. Why does this work? Because it is rich in fatty acids. This triggers mucous membranes to keep from dehydrating. This is something I'll use in Sjogren's a lot because they have mucous membrane issues in general. And it's interesting because the positive effects found in research from the sea buckthorn oil were not specifically from increased circulating estrogen, but the ability of the sea buckthorn oil to actually lubricate by adding in fatty acids. Vitamin E can be used topically or internally. I will give a word of caution though. Orally might be a better option because internally it may be effective, but oils such as vitamin E, olive oil, almond oil, coconut oil can actually build up in labial folds, become rancid, and add to smells and infections, can even cause vaginal or urinary tract infections. I spoke in my last episode about not putting any food in your vagina, and I would still stand by that. Also, vitamin E can stain your sheets and break down latex, condoms, so just be aware of that. I would probably take it orally instead, but it has been shown to be an alternative to vaginal estrogen in relieving symptoms of vaginal atrophy in postmenopausal women. If you're looking for a non-hormonal way to increase lubrication, speak to your naturopathic doctor about incorporating vitamin E. Herbs include chasteberry, chase tree, vitex. It goes by a few different names, but it's been shown to normalize sex hormones, can alleviate many symptoms of menopause, including that mood piece, that irritability. So if you're like, yeah, I have vaginal dryness, but I also have this irritability, Vitex might be a good option. Black cohosh has been seen in research to reduce vaginal dryness, but it took about 6 to 8 weeks. So you have to really be patient and you have to be persistent. Soy is a really great option, obviously non-GMO organic, but increasing your intake of whole soy foods, 2 to 3 servings a day. The goal is to get about 50 to 150 milligrams of isoflavones a day. Again, you wouldn't notice results for a number of weeks. So it's about creating a plan. And this is what I always say to my patients. If you are treating something, because I'm always treating hormones, and hormones take like 3 months to see a difference. And so if you start with something, you have to then be consistent and persistent that you're going to do it for at least 12 weeks. Now, what happens if you've really, you know, overshot and you've chosen the wrong protocol because you haven't really figured out the root cause? Well, now you're in trouble because you're going to do something for 12 weeks and you're not actually going to get any benefit after 12 weeks. You're going to waste time and you're going to waste money. So it is important before you say, I'm just going to do this or I'm just going to take this, that you consider that time and you look at, okay, I need to make sure I'm treating the right thing so that if it doesn't work, we know why, or the practitioner that I'm working with knows why, so we can navigate and re-step in the right direction here. Flaxseed is really great. I love adding flaxseed, 2 tablespoons a day in all my postmenopausal patients, because it is a good food source of phytoestrogen. It's going to help, you know, balance your estrogens really well and can help with hot flashes and things like that. So based on the literature, flaxseeds have shown a beneficial effect on hot flash frequency and intensity. And they have helped, I mean, it was in combination with a few other things, but it was helpful on alleviating vaginal atrophy, which is really cool because it is a food. It's a great source of fiber and omega-3s. And so I always say adding in that healthy fatty acids and other foods rich in omega-3s can be really helpful when we look at it from a mucous membrane perspective. Fennel was something that was looked at in research. They looked at a vaginal fennel ethanol extract cream. So it was fennel compounded in a cream, and this showed improvement of vaginal atrophy and sexual functions in menopause due to its estrogenic effects. And then something I love to do is bioidentical hormones. So typically I will do them topical on the skin, but you can actually get a compounded vaginal suppository of estrogen. So you would use a specific form of estrogen, estriol cream, and this can be really helpful. Progesterone cream, though, don't sleep on it because it can act as an estrogen modulator. I think a lot of people think, oh, estrogen deficiency, I have to add in estrogen. But progesterone actually helps the receptors. It helps prepare for estrogen. I always talk about how estrogen and progesterone work together. So progesterone cream can act as an estrogen modulator. And so if this patient would benefit from progesterone and maybe a little bit of estrogen, depending on the case, this is a really good combo. You could do a progesterone estrogen combo. But like I said, estriol cream can be compounded for vaginal use. And it is seen to not be proliferative on estrogen sensitive tissue. So it seemed to be actually protective, no increased risk for ovarian, uterine, or breast cancer. And some research shows that it can be actually protective. And so talking to your practitioner, you can actually get this and dose it appropriately. Vaginal moisturizers are available typically, you know, over the counter at a health food store or at a pharmacy, and they're formulated so that the vaginal tissues can retain moisture more effectively. These are typically applied a few times per week, and they allow a continuous moisturizing effect. But again, you need to put the difference between a moisturizer and a lubricant. A moisturizer is something that is going to help the tissues retain moisture. A lubricant is something you're just going to use before intercourse to help, you know, with lubrication at that moment. If we're looking at an estrogen deficiency, you can use moisturizers and lubricants in conjunction with estrogen replacement, or if you're looking for a non-hormonal treatment, you can use it as the alternative treatment. Some patients don't really want hormones, even if they're bioidentical, or they might have a contraindication to that, then that's a good idea. But moisturizers that contain ginseng can be helpful. Moisturizers that contain ginseng can be helpful, but you don't want to use them when you are sensitive to estrogen. So if you have a contraindication to estrogen, you want to avoid buying a moisturizer just because it says hormone-free. If it has ginseng in it, it has some estrogenic activities. So you want to make sure you avoid it. But the important thing to understand is that the length of effectiveness for a moisturizer is generally less than 24 hours. So we have to make sure that we're dosing it appropriately to see that, you know, sustained effect. The last thing I want to say about these moisturizers is we have to make sure, number one, are they safe with condoms? So if using condoms is a big part of your strategy, you know, even if pregnancy, if you're in menopause, it's obviously not for pregnancy, but the protection of STIs, we want to make sure that whatever moisturizer you're using is safe with condoms. And then I like to give this resource to all of my patients, the Environmental Working Group Skin Deep Database. You can Google it. But basically, you're going to search the product that you're looking for, and they will be ranked from 1 to 10 based on their safety. They're going to go through all of the ingredients with you and talk through whether or not things are safe, whether or not they are going to be endocrine disrupting, whether or not, you know, you should watch out for this chemical, and it tells you why. And so it can help you choose a better product, because just because it's going to be, you know, a good moisturizer, it works, and it doesn't disrupt, you know, condoms, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to not have parabens in it per se. So it's important to really look at these ingredients and then weigh your risks and benefits. And other things we look at is reducing stress, focusing on adequate sleep, adequate hydration. This goes for fertility as well. I think we underestimate the benefit of water. We need hydration to make fertile cervical mucus, as well as we need hydration to create, you know, lubrication and vaginal moisture. So I think a lot of time, especially in menopause, we tend to have bladder issues. And so you might find yourself waking up to pee and, you know, you're like, I can't drink a lot of water or liquid during the day. So adequate hydration is really important. And then seeing a pelvic floor or physiotherapist, you can reach out to me if you're in the area and you want a recommendation. Yoga, so pelvic floor exercises that you can do with your practitioner or at home, and yoga can be helpful as well. So that's wrapping up our episode on dryness and feeling broken. And I'm hoping that this has allowed to give you some hope if this is something you're struggling with. Like I said, as always, you can find me on social at Dr. Laura ND on TikTok and Instagram. And I will see you next week. Bye.